think I'd come to New Mexico and get an introduction like that, because it's pretty tough to live up to it. I'll do the best I can. What I want to talk to you about today, though, strangely enough, has to do with introductions like that and related subjects. I'd like to share with you some of the things that I personally have been experiencing in my several roles in this field on a topic that I believe to be the most powerful force in human society, and that is perception. The longer that I practice public relations, the more I come to realize that that is really the bottom line, not just for those of us who are practitioners, and not just for those of you who are managers, but that really is the bottom line in human society. We are pretty much the creatures of our perceptions of others, and of others' perceptions of us. I want to tell you a story that you've probably all heard, but I think it makes the point, so I'm going to tell it anyway. And that's about the Premier of France, who's been doing some traveling. And he went to Washington and met with Ronnie, and he noticed that on Ronnie's desk there were three telephones. You've all heard this joke, I assume. I read, I don't know this joke well, things travel slowly. on Reagan's desk are three telephones. A red, a white, and a blue. And so the premier asked the president, why do you have these three phones? And he said, well, the red one, of course, is the hotline to Moscow. The white one is to call my wife. And the blue one is to talk to God. The premier was quite impressed with this. And he said, I have a red one too, you know, and I've got a white one, but I don't have a blue one, so would it be okay, could I use your phone to talk to God for you? So we got on the phone and started having a conversation with God. In fact, it went on for about 15 minutes. And when he was finished, he hung up and he thanked the president and said, that was really marvelous, what do I owe you? And the president got out his pocket calculator, you know, and he worked it up. He said, well, with tax, that'll be about $500. So the premier paid up and went on his way. A few days later, he was in Israel, meeting with Prime Minister Begin, and he noticed, lo and behold, that he had three phones on his desk, a red, a white, and a blue. So the premier said to him, why do you have these three phones? He said, well, the red one is my hotline to Washington, and the white one is to talk to my wife, and the blue one is to talk to God. Well, the French premier thought that was rather nice, and he wanted to check and see if this really was the same telephone company. So he said, would it be all right if I used your blue one and spoke to God for a few minutes? And the premier said, sure, that's fine, go ahead. So he got on the phone and had another conversation with God, and it lasted about the same 15 minutes. And he hung up, and he turned to the prime minister, and he said, that was really nice. What do I owe you? And without batting an eyelash, Begin said, that'll be 10 cents. The premier looked at him and he said, no, wait a minute. He said, I have to tell you, I've just come from Washington. And he said, Reagan has the same three phones. And he said, I talked to God for about the same length of time there, and it cost me $500. Here, he says, it's only a dime. How come? Reagan said, simple. Here, it's a local call. I submit to you that this perception by that particular country of itself and of its role is probably the reason that it is able to do the things that it is doing today with vast criticism, much support, but vast criticism, and yet is able to plunge forward in an alien world as a tiny little country, because it has a perception of itself that that joke in an odd way personifies. You know, there are a lot of perceptions, and I've, of course, been reading the local media, and I noticed the other day how the media sometimes perceive some of our work and some of our managers' work. There's a lovely story here about that wonderful project, WIPP, and the writer from this journal wants everybody to know that the managers in charge of this, when they were questioned by the press, it says here, rejected the suggestion that this new brine hole they want to build for $784,000, quote, was not simply an expensive public relations move. In other words, they really weren't going to spend almost $1 million to drill this brine hole on the WIP project purely for public relations. I think that tells us something, perhaps, about the media or public critics' view, perhaps, of what we do, and oftentimes of what our managers do, that we may be doing things purely to make an impression, that is to say, to set a perception. Our perceptions of the human society in which we live, I think, are subject to great change today. We used to talk about nothing is certain except death and taxes. Today you have to change that. You have to say nothing is certain except death, taxes, and change. Public relations professionals know that basically we must be managers of change, and yet our perceptions, I think, of the world haven't quite caught up with that. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker recently, however, that made the point for me. A young man is kneeling beside his bed, saying his prayers before going to sleep, and this is what the caption says. The caption says, "And please give me good abstract reasoning ability, interpersonal skills, cultural perspective, linguistic comprehension, and a high sociodynamic potential." Now that isn't what I used to pray for. And maybe that tells us something about the changes, but the question I guess we have to ask is, have our perceptions of this society kept up with that kind of language? I have some questions as to whether they have. How about our perceptions as organizational persons? As persons who know a heck of a lot about the outfits that we run or work for. As you know, I've been in town, several of us from our firm, working with the university. We work with a lot of universities around the country, and since no one, I believe, is here from the university, I'll pick on them and point out that educators, because they are educated themselves, better educated than most of us, know more, in other words, about education, very often come across as rather arrogant on this subject. I doubt that there's anyone in this room, if we could go out in the corner one by one and talk about that, that wouldn't confirm that occasionally educators may come across this way about the topic of education. Of course, because they are better educated and work in educational institutions, they therefore feel they make better decisions on that topic and often do not listen to the public, because their feeling is that the public's perceptions could not possibly be right. The public's perceptions, on the other hand, are usually quite different. And if you look at the court of public opinion in which American society operates, you have to learn pretty much to trust the people. And yet so many of us, because we know so much about our institutions, kind of rise above that feeling of trusting the people and their perceptions. And we try instead to institute our ideas. Now, obviously that doesn't apply to anyone in this room, because I'm sure we're beyond that stage. But I think you get the point. Because we know a great deal, we sometimes fail to listen to the perceptions of others. This situation is going to get worse because of the new technologies of communication. When I see yesterday that the FCC has finally approved direct broadcast satellite transmission, this will open up hundreds of new television channels in every community in the world. In addition to that, the computer revolution, all this marvelous new ability that we have to transfer information. What is our perception of that as professionals? I'm very concerned about this topic because I think we are tending, many of us, to look at this as some kind of a panacea that's going to solve problems, going to enable us to get messages out where we couldn't do it before. My personal perception is that it isn't going to be like that at all. That indeed, what we say is still all that really counts. And the media that we happen to have available to get our message out is mere technology. And that still, for public relations practitioners, dealing with the perceptions of our audience and our own perceptions is going to remain the key ingredient. Which brings me to a perception I have about public relations practice. And I'd like to just share this with you over here if I can, because it troubles me greatly. We talk a good deal about our skills, about our ability to frame messages, if you will, and elicit feedback to bring about accommodations in the court of public opinion. But in looking at what we do, I like to compare it with a paradigm that we educators who study educational theory use. They like to talk about six levels of learning, if you will, of shared information and communication. And here's how they divide the six levels up. At the bottom is written information shared back and forth. Here they put visual information, things that one can see. Above that, they put what they call exhibits. That is to say, things that one cannot just see, but one can begin to participate in, to perhaps feel, handle. And they draw a line there. And above that, they have three other areas. They talk about learning by demonstration, as opposed to learning by a mere exhibit, which is stationary. Demonstration, which is someone showing you how things are happening. And then they talk about contrived involvement, which means perhaps using an advisory panel, or maybe some kind of a game technique that you've developed to let people artificially be involved with what you're doing. And then they talk about involvement, actually involving people in what happens. Now, if you look at this six-level paradigm here of learning modes, an interesting thing occurs as to how we in public relations have operated. About 90% of what we do is right there at the bottom of the effectiveness pyramid. Slowly we've moved up into here. Sometimes we get here. We've had a very difficult time getting up into true public involvement. Now the interesting thing is that if you will look at these types of activities based on effectiveness studies, which the psychologists have been doing for years, the news is rather bad. People remember, they tell us, 20% of what they are told or read. They remember, let's find the page here, 30% of what they see of the visual mode, and they remember 50% of what they both see and hear or read. On the other hand, people remember 70% of what they say, which is apt to be here in a demonstration, in an exhibit, perhaps in contrived involvement where they get a chance to talk about it. And people remember 90% of what they do, of their actual involvement. This has reshaped my perception of the public relations profession, of what we should be doing, and of what our bosses ought to be asking from us, because I don't think this has been the way we have operated. In fact, we talked for a long time about dealing with opinion, that our role was to shape or to react to public opinion. Then we moved very carefully over to dealing with attitudes. We felt that opinions were too quickly changed, and certainly they are. All the studies that we have indicate that opinions are very flighty things. You need only participate in an election campaign to know how quickly people's opinions can change. So we thought, well, we better get at something that's a little deeper than opinion. We better start dealing with people's attitudes, the way that they really think about life, and from which their opinions spring. Today, I believe that is inadequate. I think people who practice public relations today must be involved neither in opinions nor attitudes solely, but in behavior. Our goal has to be to make our institutions, our ideas, our products or services, whatever we represent, so much a part of people's daily living that they in fact will behave in a certain way. Let me give you a very good example that's been on the front pages. The ERA has apparently failed. But 68% of all Americans favor the ERA. Even in the last two states where legislatures turned it down, majorities over 60% favor the ERA, and yet it failed. But we say we live in the court of public opinion, where how people feel about an issue determines the outcome. Why then did the ERA fail? We have worked with the ERA people on a national basis, and I think I know why it failed, because they were interested in dealing with people's opinions and not in motivating those people to express those opinions through behavior that was clearly understood by the legislators that had to make that decision. They did not deal with getting an idea expressed through people's behavior. And that, I believe, is why the ERA is failing. Well, if these are the perceptions of many types with which we must deal, and if this is a problem that we face, I think we have to change our perceptions, or at least think about changing our perceptions, both as practitioners and as managers, about this function that we call public relations. I think that public relations practitioners, in fact, have six roles that we cannot duck. Let me just share those with you. You see, I like to practice what I preach here. I don't only want you to hear this, I want you to see it as well. The first role that public relations practitioners have to become expert in, if we aren't already, is as researchers. If you look at the public relations process, the ideal public relations process, about 60% of the activities in that process turn out to be research-based, or to be actually doing research. If you're not comfortable being a researcher, I think you're going to be very uncomfortable in either managing or performing public relations tasks in the years to come. The second thing that we have to do is counseling. It doesn't do us a bit of good to be able to help our organizations, to know what ought to be done, if we aren't able to persuade our fellow managers that that's the course to take. That, of course, is done through counseling. We have to become expert at that, and our managers ought to demand that of us, that we come forth and candidly state, this is how my professional skills and the body of knowledge that I have tell me we should deal with the current situation. If managers aren't doing that, they're making a mistake. If we aren't offering that, we are not doing all that we could do for our institution. The third thing that I don't see how we can possibly be left out of or duck today is to be strategic planners. You've heard Tom already say that our role has to be to know what is about to occur, to be able to anticipate issues, not just to put the fire out once it gets started. One does that by strategic planning. Every organization today that is apt to survive does strategic planning. The question is, are we public relations professionals really participating in it, and in many ways taking a lead in it, because perception is ultimately what means success or failure, maybe even survival for institutions today. The fourth role that we have is that of teachers. It's funny, I talked earlier about how we know so much about our own field that we're sometimes a little arrogant about it. I'm afraid that's probably true of most of us in public relations. We talk all the time about handling somebody's public relations. Why handle the public relations for Jones and Company? You ever said that? But you know, do we really do that? I don't think we can. I can't begin working with UNM to handle their public relations, because the public relationships between that institution with 30 or 40,000 students and a staff of 7,000, 8,000 people is going to be determined ultimately by the relationship expressed between all of those people and all the members of the general public with which they interact. In other words, the public relations of your outfit and mine may be planned by us. It may be facilitated by us. But it happens where the lowest level, newest employee meets the public, to say nothing of those of us who've been around for a while. So if we really want good public relations, we have to become excellent teachers and show everybody in the outfit their responsibility for public relationships. This, I think, is one of the least understood, least utilized areas by practitioners. And I think we're going to be getting into it very deeply. You know the old story. Organizations spend several million dollars on a public relations program every year, and a very important person calls into the switchboard and is told, yes! The money just went down the tubes, because that's the interaction that sets up the relationships. We're going to have to be teachers. One of the things, by the way, that we're doing wherever we can convince our clients is we're writing public relations responsibilities into the job description of every job in the organization. Every single job, and that means those people are rated on it, their pay is to some extent dependent on it, and my oh my, don't they suddenly have an interest in being good public relations representatives. The fifth thing that we are, of course, we are communicators. But I would ask you to suspend your disbelief for a moment and notice where it comes on the list. And notice that it's only one out of what are going to be six items. I'll talk about that in a minute. The sixth thing that we must be, and I know some of you won't like this, the sixth thing that we have to be in our organizations. Is cheerleaders. If you want to get a good idea of how important a cheerleader is, talk to an anthropologist. Anthropologists can convince you, probably as they have me, where I got that idea, in about 2 minutes flat, that any society, any social grouping, without a cheerleader, is doomed to fail. And the history of mankind from earliest time shows, and we, after all, whose job is all these other things, are the ideally situated persons to be the cheerleaders. And I don't think we can die. Well, if those are our roles, how are we going to bring this to bear on an organization to really help the, quote, bottom line, whatever your bottom line is? Evaluation has become a big thing in public relations, and it's about time, I think, that we got accountable, that we told what we do and how we do it and why we try to do it. The thing that's been missing has been some kind of a matrix to tell what public relations can do. Well, of course, I just happen to have one here, and I'd like to see how it looks to you. I think there are seven ways that public relations activities carried out in these six modes can directly and definitely affect the bottom line of your outfit, and I'm talking now about dollars, because that's everybody's bottom line. I'm talking about beds filled if you're a hospital, or health education performed, or students enrolled, of whatever your bottom lines are. The first bottom line, the first thing that public relations can do to affect the bottom line is the traditional publicity promotion activity that is so familiar to us all. Because after all, if you don't have awareness by your public of what you do and that the service or product or whatever is available to them, your bottom line is going to suffer. And if that's so obvious, I'm not going to spend any more time on it. The second way that public relations activities affect the bottom line is by motivating others. That's this internal teaching job that I'm talking about. It's also the internal communications, the internal relationships for which we are usually responsible. It's our job to motivate people, to cheerlead them, if you will, to build the climate in the institution so that folks will be more productive, just to use a word that has now become very much the buzzword. We have an assignment there. All you have to do is look at an organization with unmotivated people, and you know how many bucks it costs their bottom line. We can affect the bottom line by motivating people. Thirdly, is the principle that managers often call no surprises. Because we have relationships with external publics as well as internal publics, because part of our role is to know what the perceptions of those people out there are as well as inside, we're the ones that ought to be the early warning system, and we usually are. We're the issue anticipators. That means we can help an organization avoid surprises. And do surprises ever cost money on the bottom line? Have you ever had a surprise all of a sudden in your outfit? Something you didn't know was going to happen? Did that cost you dough? Did it take you away from your day-to-day activities, where your efforts ought to go? Of course it did. That's what surprises do. But we have the capability to add to the bottom line by avoiding surprises. This means, of course, that we know something about emerging issues, that we become the in-house futurists, but it's all part of our six-mold role as public relations practitioners. The fourth thing that I believe we can do is to point out new opportunities. Because we have an advantage that our bosses often don't have, and many of our fellow managers and fellow workers, of getting out to the public, of dealing with our various audiences, we're the ones that often can see a new opportunity. Sometimes it's as simple as sending out a news release on a new product and getting an inquiry back where somebody says, gee, do you suppose I could use this product for this application? And this application turns out to be one nobody ever thought of. And suddenly, there's a whole new market. It can be that simple, but it happens all the time if we remember that it's one of the ways we can affect the bottom line. The fifth thing that we can do is a kind of an intellectual thing in a sense, but we are the folks who are generally charged with retaining the current position when crises and surprises do strike. Isn't that right? We are the firefighters. When the bad times come, we're the ones that are supposed to get out there and say, now just cool it, you know, everything's okay, we're going to come out of this. And because we can do that and do it well, we can affect the bottom line. If we can take a hot issue that's going to divert everybody's efforts for maybe weeks and cool it down, get it back to rationality, that means dollars on the bottom line. And we can do that. This is something that we can definitely do and have proven time and again that we can do. And sixthly, and this may be our most important job, and I hope all the bosses are listening, we can motivate management. We can open the eyes and ears of the boss, of the board, of those fellow managers with whom we work to what's really going on out there. You've all read article after article, probably heard speeches on management isolation. If our managers are isolated, I don't think it's only their fault. I think it's our fault. Because remember that definition of public relations practitioners as the people in the middle, the ones that know what's going on inside and are in touch with all those internal publics, and who also know what's going on outside with all those external publics, and then like ambassadors have to sit right here in the middle and bring those two groups together. You know, if your boss every once in a while doesn't say, whose side are you on, you may not be doing the job, because we have to interpret those external publics and their perceptions inside, just as we interpret our internal goals and objectives outside. Well, these are six ways in which public relations can affect the bottom line, something on which we can be judged, on which we can be rated. I think we can do all those things, and if you're not already doing them, I hope you'll give some thought to it. Well, of course, I'm giving you my perceptions. You may disagree with some of these. You have every right to do so. But let me add somebody else's perception now that goes even beyond the bottom line I've been talking about. Philip Morris is a rather interesting corporation. It's interesting, first of all, because the chairman and chief executive officer is a member of PRSA, who began as the director of public relations, moved up through the organization, and George Weissman is now the chairman of this multi-billion-dollar worldwide organization. But it's also interesting because the company has had a social responsibility, which is somewhat unique. It's unique, first of all, because it began as a cigarette company and all of the criticism that that implies. But the activities that the company has taken have been remarkable. And they, in their last annual report, began looking at themselves in a different way. And they now talk about the double bottom line. This is the phrase these days inside of Philip Morris. Everyone is asked, how have you contributed to the double bottom line? The dollar and cents bottom line, of course, is the first bottom line. The second or double bottom line is social responsibility. As a matter of fact, they have issued a statement which points out that you cannot isolate one kind of activity in an organization from another. Therefore, those things that we do to meet our dollar bottom line of necessity affect what we do to meet or fail to meet our social bottom line. And they talk about the social bottom line as those generally intangible social consequences of all of their actions. And they are now making an annual report in which they talk about both kinds of bottom line. They claim, very simply, that by doing some social accounting, you in fact help to determine your dollar bottom line. Now, why do you suppose they say that? George is very clear about it. He says, the perceptions people have of our company can be proven through our experience plus research to affect how we do at the sales meeting. Certainly none of us who are practitioners would ever dispute that, and I doubt that many managers would. Well, that's their perception. Let me just share one other with you. The president of Gulf Oil has a saying in his board meetings. He says, every problem we have, every single thing we meet here and talk about and turns out to be a problem, we view as a public relations problem. He says, because here's why. It never turns out to be a problem of transportation or a problem of marketing or a problem of finance. He said that after his 40 years as an executive in a big company, he found out that every single problem turned out to be a people problem somewhere. Somebody goofed off, somebody screwed up, somebody didn't get the message. And he said, since this kind of activity, this people relationships, is the area of public relations in our company, therefore, we simply look at every problem we have as a public relations problem. I think that's a tremendous challenge. I think it means we have to learn the six ways that we can affect our particular bottom lines. Maybe there are two or three more in your institution. I think it's propelling us into those six roles that I talked about, whether we have up until now had a perception of it or not. You know, we are really not communicators. That is, we are not strictly communicators. Certainly are not basically communicators. I'm going to emphasize that point, and I hope everything I've said here is done now. Yes, we know more about communications than anyone else in our organization, and we certainly ought to. We're going to learn tremendous amounts of new material as the new communications media come online. But if we step back into the old-fashioned comfort, the old perception of the role of the public relations professional as the internal communicator, the house communicator, I think that's a cop. I think, in fact, that if we do that, we are not meeting the challenge of our profession, and we are certainly not meeting the needs of our bosses. If we are telling our bosses that we are basically communicators, that's what my friend Phil Leslie would say is a discommunication. I want to close by giving you an example of a discommunication that I hope will drive this point into your minds in a somewhat unforgettable way. Some of you may remember, this is kind of a New Mexico story too, now that I think about it. In 1959, until 1959, citizens of the United States were not considered mature enough or whatever to be able to read racy literature. There was certainly no Playboy, no Playgirl, none of that stuff. That would have gotten you into jail immediately. And a publisher in New York thought that it was time that the First Amendment started applying to everybody. And so he made arrangements to publish in this country a world-famous racy book, which would then result in a Supreme Court case. It did. In 1959, the Supreme Court finally said that it was all right for Americans to read Lady Chatterley's Lover. Now, that's a New Mexico story, of course, because D.A. Lawrence, the author, spent a great amount of time here. In case you're not familiar with Lady Chatterley, let me give you a quick synopsis of the plot. There's this rich English lord who is crippled, okay, got that? Rich, crippled English lord. And his beautiful young wife, who is in no way crippled. And a handsome young gamekeeper on their estate. Now you can kind of fill in the action there, but that's the basic plot. Well, since the character was a gamekeeper, a magazine called Field and Stream, which of course is a hunting and fishing magazine, felt that they ought to review Lady Chatterley's Lover. So I want to read you this great miscommunication from the 1959 November issue of Field and Stream. I think it will make it important. Although written many years ago, Lady Chatterley's Lover had just been admitted into the United States. This fictional account of the day-by-day life of an English gamekeeper, they should have it, is still of considerable interest to outdoor-minded readers. It contains many passages on pheasant raising, the apprehending of poachers, ways to control vermin, and other chores and duties of the professional gamekeeper. Unfortunately, one is obliged to wade through many pages of extraneous material in order to savor these sidelights on the management of a Midland shooting estate. In this reviewer's opinion, the book will never take the place of J.R. Miller's Practical Gamekeeper. My message is simple. I think if we want to do the job for our organizations, for our bosses, and for ourselves as professionals, we're going to have to give up good old J.R. Miller's Practical Gamekeeper and get a little Lady Chatterley into what we do. My experience with strategic planning is that that's about the major thing that we do. Most strategic planning is done by computer, let us say. Demographics and dollar figures and projected sales and kilowatt hours and student load and all of that are put together, and this marvelous printout comes out and says, well, this is what you got to do. But of course, it isn't going to work out that way. And you and I know it isn't going to work out that way because those are human beings that got to do it. And we know that human beings are terribly unpredictable and are not going to do something because the plan says they should. Therefore, my feeling is that a good strategic plan is one that really deals with human nature, one that knows how to temper the numbers, temper the requirements, if you will, with the probable response of people. And I find that that is almost universally lacking in strategic planning. We have an interesting way that we do strategic planning. As a matter of fact, this is a plug, I guess. We're going to do, I'm coming back, you're going to have to put up with me again in November. And we're going to have a one-day seminar. The chapter's going to have a one-day seminar. And I'm going to share with you our famous meat paper planning process. We call it that because to do our planning, we use this big brown meat wrapping paper, you know, that they use in the supermarket. And we really do. We just put it up on the wall. We start planning at one end and we end at the other. That's in November. What we do in our process to get the human element built in to strategic planning is to follow the simple basic rule of sociology. basic rule of sociology, as I understand it, is that any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Now, that abuse may be real, it may be historic or current, it may be perceived. But if Mrs. Smith thinks that PNM ripped her off, our friends here can tell you that that's just as difficult to deal with if she's dead wrong. Because we know that in public relations, perceptions are facts. And so we make what we call abuse lists. And we look at every public that we're planning for or that is involved in our operation that is either a stakeholder or that somehow will be involved. And we make a list. What have we done in the past that they considered an abuse? What are we doing now that they feel abused about? And more importantly, what might we do that would rip them off and they would think it was an abuse? And by plugging that into our strategic planning, we've been able to do an awful lot of issue anticipation and avoid the front page headlines that my local plan has relished for so long. That's what we have found about plugging into the public relations element. Any other questions?
But the boss is here.
just to highlight a little bit about what Pat said, on November 12th, that's going to be on Friday the 12th, we are going to hold again our seminar that we hold each year, a day-long seminar on public relations training for the advanced person as well as the beginner. We get a lot of people coming in that are just got the new assignment or other duties that are assigned to public relations. And Pat is going to be here and going to conduct the seminar for us this year, and I think it's going to be outstanding. I think you've got an idea of just some of his thinking, and I hope that you will make a point of attending, you or your staff, bring the boss. That one is a good one too. But this is going to be a real good session on really how to get in touch with the public and how to do our job more effectively. Otherwise, I hope you all have a good summer. Don Keller's coming up on August 13th, on Friday the 13th. We hope all of you can make it, all the members, and you'll hear more about it. Thanks for coming. We'll see you all later.
By the way, I made a tape of Pat's presentation, so if anybody wants a copy tape, just give me a blank tape and I'll make a copy for you. It has to be a 90-minute tape.
Whatever, yeah.
You invited me?